Iowa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Wendy Gillette. Israeli tanks pushed deeper into central and southern Gaza overnight, targeting refugee camps where the military says Hamas is operating. The BBC's Yolan Nell.
We've had people continuing to flee from urban refugee camps. They're heading in search of greater safety in places like Deir al-Balah in the center of the Gaza Strip and also in Rafah in the south, right on the border with Egypt. That's now extremely overcrowded.
The Gaza Health Ministry says over 21,000 Palestinians have been killed and more than 56,000 hurt since the war started in October. A storm is bringing more massive waves to California following flooding and damage to homes and buildings Thursday. Kenny Powell lives in Ventura.
Not an ordinary day. We had the biggest waves we've had in many years. And we always look forward to the big waves, but Mother Nature had a little more than we had planned for.
Thin ice is increasingly becoming an issue in Minnesota. KBJR-TV's Dan Wolf on the latest incident on Upper Red Lake.
According to the Beltrami County Sheriff's Office, a total of 122 people were evacuated by boat from an ice floe after it detached from shore. The call came in just before 5 p.m. At one point, before rescue crews arrived, bystanders tried to canoe to the ice floe to evacuate the anglers that way, but four people fell into open water. They were brought back to the ice floe to warm in a fishing shelter. After 3 hours, all stranded anglers were brought to shore safely and no injuries were reported.
Police say a teenage boy who told them an intruder attacked his family is actually the true suspect. KGBE-TV reporter Penn Boris has more on the case in Fresno County, California.
Detectives have arrested a 14-year-old teenage boy in connection with the murder of two adults and the attempted murder of an 11-year-old girl.
Fresno County Sheriff John Zanoni breaking the shocking news Friday afternoon that the unnamed 14-year-old was arrested for the double homicide Wednesday night in the 47,000 block of Dunlap Road in Miramonte. They say the teenager killed both of his parents, identified as 37-year-olds Lou Yang and Si Vang, and attacked his 11-year-old sister, leaving her critically injured, all as his 7-year-old younger brother was inside the home.
An appeals court has ruled Capitol Police officers can proceed with a lawsuit against former President Donald Trump.
Donald Trump can still be sued civilly for money damages by January 6 victims, including injured police. And the court also announced it will hear 1 hour of arguments on the question of presidential immunity in Trump's federal interference case. Those arguments are coming up January 9th.
Scott McFarland reporting. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credit.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new report finds smart toys pose all kinds of serious risks for families. Mike Moan reports.
The smart toy market is now a more than $16 billion industry and is expected to double by 2027. This holiday season, experts are warning parents to check the safety and privacy features of toys children receive. Teresa Murray with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group Education Fund says stuffed animals, baby dolls, racer tracks, and even board games may have features that allow them to record conversations and collect personal information and location data.
They have microphones or cameras, or they connect to an app, or they're Wi-Fi enabled or Bluetooth. They have geolocators, which is a whole thing. So parents really need to ask a lot of questions when it comes to these smart toys.
This year, the Federal Trade Commission and Department of Justice charged Amazon with violating the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act rule by deceiving parents and users of the Alexa voice assistant service about its data deletion practices. The company allegedly kept voice recordings of children and gathered geolocation data and used children's transcripts. Congress did pass tougher toy safety regulations in 2008, triggering a spike in recall toys that suddenly didn't meet safety standards. Murray says that while the number of unsafe toys has gradually decreased, parents still should inspect their children's toys.
Especially if you're talking about a younger child. But inspect that toy and make sure that none of the parts have come loose. Nothing could come off that could could endanger them or be a choking hazard.
And while toy-related deaths and injuries treated in emergency rooms among children 14 and younger have declined, hospitals and doctors' offices around the country still see more than 150,000 toy-related injuries a year. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, cloudy skies with some drizzle and snow. We'll see a high near 33. For tonight, snow and 27. Chance of snow on your Sunday, cloudy skies and a high near 33. For Sunday night, partly cloudy, a low of 19. New Year's Day, sunshine and 32.
It's 30 at our studios.
Local talk about our hometown and all of Wisconsin has gone untapped until now. You're on 93.5 The Tap. Make sure and tell your friends.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, December 30th, 2023. This is our final broadcast here of our Saturday morning Times in Discussion with you, our 78th broadcast since going on the air about 18 months ago. A very special broadcast this morning. Thank you for joining me here on the studios of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and next hour as well. This is our weekly review, our analysis, our examination of some of those most significant recent events, news stories, events, significant things happening in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. As always this morning, as I am every single Saturday morning, supported and assisted by my stellar producer, Anya. Together, we're in the studios here of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha. But we are transmitting to stations, places, cities, regions throughout the state of Wisconsin and even beyond, and inviting, as always, your participation in our discussion this morning. Phone number is 844-967-2789. Once again, that's 844-967-2789. Or you can also go on the Civic Media website, the app, find your particular broadcast station, find the Morning Cannoli folder, pull it down and be a part of our discussion. Send a question, send an inquiry, a comment, an observation to Anya and me, and we will also take those comments, questions, observations on the air as well. The phone number, once again, 844-967-2789. This, our final broadcast of 2023, but continuing well into 2024 and beyond to talking with you about these important issues in the life and livelihood of our nation and our world. This morning, as always, we have an ambitious, but I believe achievable agenda. Lots and lots of things to talk about on this special edition of our Saturday morning broadcast. Hopefully, as always, informative and maybe even inspiring. We're going to spend some time in our second hour talking about inspiration and the things that we can do and think about into 2024 and beyond. And always, we ask three important questions as we examine those news items, discuss them with you, talk about why they're significant. We begin always with the question, what happened? What do we know? What are the facts of a particular event, a circumstance? We've got to have discussion based upon a common knowledge of the things as we understand them. Second, why are those things important? Why are they significant? Why are they relevant or material to our lives? And third, what do we do? What are the things that we should do in response? What are appropriate reactions, answers? Those can be very diverse, both in terms of action and words, but also important to recognize that in many instances, actions and words are important in response to what we know, identifying those important things in our lives. this morning. As always, we do have a syllabus on this, our last show of 2023, that is indeed ambitious, but hopefully very achievable with your participation as well. We're going to begin with some two rule of law snapshots this morning, one of them coming out of Texas, the other one coming out of Illinois. And we're going to chat about both of those in just a couple of minutes or so. And then we're going to go back to the Supreme Court, as we always do, to talk about what the case docket looks like today. 50 cases presently pending before the United States Supreme Court. We're going to talk about some administrative cases, some agency cases, highlight those in terms of this understanding about the administrative state, which is a part of the present campaign in America. We're going to talk about the three, count them, three cases pending before the United States Supreme Court right now, having to do with a candidate for the presidency. His name is Donald Trump. And then we're also going to take some of your questions that you have sent to me over the period of the last several weeks, talking about the implications of what could happen in context of trials and other proceedings in our courts in 2024. Then we're going to get back to lessons learned, observations, perspectives on why the things we've talked about for the past three broadcasts in connection with the promises of the Trump campaign and presidential candidate Donald Trump, why are those things important on an individual level? What are the consequences of embracing them by their possibly happening in a second Trump term? I'm going to talk about why those things are significant in your lives. And then we're also going to talk about ways in which in 2024 and beyond, you can be involved in all of these kinds of things as we go forward. Let us begin, however, with a point, a personal privilege, right here at the start of our show. This past week, we lost Herb Cole, United States Senator who died this past Wednesday at the age of 88. He's a former United States Senator, former owner of the Milwaukee Bucks right here in Milwaukee, right here in Wisconsin. He is, of course, a Wisconsin Democrat, co-founder of the Kohl's department store chain, and served as our senator, one of our two senators, for 24 years here in the state of Wisconsin. He was a lifelong basketball fan, notably bought his hometown team for about $18 million way back in 1985. He was also a philanthropist, spending a lot of time on education. I'm going to get back to that in just a moment or so, focusing on teachers, students, schools in the state of Wisconsin. Upon his passing this past Wednesday, President Joe Biden honored our former senator and businessman, calling Herb Cole one of the finest people he has ever served with when he was in the United States Senate. He said, in all of our years of friendship and time spent serving his beloved Wisconsin, Herb's humility was always an immense source of strength for him and for all of us blessed to know him. That's a comment by President Joe Biden just this past week. Went on to say he embodied the simple truth that we are a great nation because we are a good people. Indeed, Herb Cole, born in Milwaukee, right here in Wisconsin, 1935 to immigrants, spent his childhood, by all accounts, sweeping up in the family grocery store, playing stickball with his friends. That included Bud Selig, who again will later become the Major League Baseball commissioner. Cole graduated from the University of Wisconsin, got an MBA from Harvard, and also served in the United States Army Reserve. He was, during the course of his term in the Senate, also a part of the Senate Aging Committee, chaired that committee, served on the Judiciary and Appropriations Committee, and according to the Herb Cole Education Fund and other reliable sources out there, was one of the most effective senators in our nation's history when it comes to education and focusing upon all of that. And that leads to my point of personal observation this morning. When Barack Obama was elected president in November of 2008, shortly after that, the president, the White House, and the senators from all the different states throughout the union solicited applications for United States attorneys in each of the 92 districts that populate our nation. And I decided in early 2009 to submit my application as a part of this process. And while the process does involve a lot of paper, a lot of background checking, appropriately so, it also involved, with great pride on my part, the opportunity to speak with our two senators. And that included, of course, Russ Feingold, who was our junior senator at that time, interviewed with him in the federal courthouse in downtown Milwaukee, a very academic, intellectually focused interview. that included questions, among other things, about my favorite 19th century Supreme Court justice. Don't quiz me on that this morning. Focusing upon what it means to be involved in the administration of justice, a transcendent interview with Russ Feingold. I also remember very well another interview with Herb Kohl. It took place on the second floor of Watts Tea Room in downtown Wisconsin. And over egg salad sandwiches and chicken noodle soup, Herb Kohl and I talked about humanity. Talked a lot about his focus on education, his focus on teachers, students, and the importance of civics when it comes to understanding our world. He asked me at one point, why is it you want to be the United States Attorney? And we talked about the importance of a secure and a safe district, a secure and a safe state, a secure and state nation. We also, however, talked about the humanity and the importance that a United States Attorney and the Department of Justice brings to supporting the life and the livelihood, a phrase I often use not only on this broadcast but in other parts of my life, the life and the livelihood of our people. That was what Herb Kohl was all about. That's what he quizzed me about before making the determination, along with Russ Feingold, to send my name onto the White House as a possible nominee for the position of U.S. Attorney. Russ Feingold, during that interview, once again impressed me not only as a man of business and common sense and practicality, but also someone who understood the reality of engaging with human beings, not only his constituents throughout the state of Wisconsin, but also those who specially needed his help. Again, focusing on education, the importance of growth intellectually, growth emotionally, and the ways that that can be done, especially a focus on civics. I dare say that when years later the leadership of Civic Media asked me to do this radio program, I was inspired in part by the things that Herb Kohl told me about the importance of civics and the importance of civic education as an understanding about our life, our livelihood, our nation, and our state. I'm going to get back to that at the end of our second hour here this morning. This morning, we do recognize the life, the transcendent life, the important life, the contributions, the service of Herb Kohl, United States Senator who passed away just this past week. We remember him with honor. We remember him for the contributions he made to our lives and our livelihoods. Let us now continue with the rule of law, as Herb Kohl would commission us all to do, beginning with a couple of stories this Saturday morning that come from Texas and come from Illinois. Both of them important illustrations, both of them important instructions on the ways in which we should understand the world around us and will animate a lot of discussion that's coming up in our next couple of hours. Let me begin with one coming out of the state of Texas. And in particular, it has to do with the Constitution of the United States of America. We chat a lot about that on this broadcast. It has to do with an invocation of the meaning and the import of what our founding fathers wrote many, many years ago. Just this past week, implementing in the wake of Governor Greg Abbott's signature on a bill making illegal immigration a state crime. That happening just this past week. Governor Greg Abbott actually traveled to the Rio Grande Valley about 10 days or so to sign into law three state laws that pour money into a three-year effort of his to deter illegal immigration. Some of that is entirely appropriate. Some of that is a part of state action that he is undertaking to address what is undeniably an immigration and border problem that we all have here in the United States of America. $1.54 billion in monies. Other things coming up in that state statute, which we will chat about right after this first break on our Saturday morning broadcast.
.5 The Tap.
When I first had my baby, I'd get comments all the time about how happy I must be. I remember thinking, I want to be happy. Why don't I feel that way? It was hard to admit that, even to my doctor. But I'm glad I did. She told me it was postpartum depression, and that is very treatable. These days, things are feeling good, and we're both happier about that. Right, little man? I'll take that as a yes.
Mental health care is working for Simone. See what it can do for you at mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
Latrell spent more than 8 years in foster care. His world changed when he was adopted at 15 with help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption.
I think about how much we love him, and I wish we could have had him for his entire childhood.
The Foundation is changing the lives of thousands of teens waiting in foster care. You can help. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you once again for joining Anya and me in our discussion of all things law, government, and justice in America, beginning this morning with two rule of law snapshots that are also a wonderful introduction into the larger issues that we're going to talk about this morning in connection with the future of America. Discussing at the top of our program this morning, this legislation recently passed by the Texas legislature, signed into law, state law, by Governor Greg Abbott of the state of Texas. Again, about $1.54 billion in state monies, another $40 million for state troopers, all of that to patrol the Colony Ridge housing development near Houston, do other things to support the state efforts there to address the immigration problem that we all have in the United States of America. The significant portion of the package of legislation that the governor signed just recently is this. Senate Bill 4 creates a state crime for illegally crossing the border from Mexico. That's a new law, and it's almost certainly likely to force a legal showdown with the federal government on whether or not it is valid, it is legitimate under our Constitution. The related bill sent under Senate Bill 4 makes it not only a violation of law in the state of Texas, but also increases the minimum sentence there from 2 years to 10 years for smuggling immigrants or operating a stash house. Now, why is all this significant? Why is it an important rule of law issue to discuss here on our last show of the year? Because it underscores the connection between states and the Constitution itself. The laws funding the border barrier and making crossing illegally a state crime will go into effect in March, not right away. The human smuggling law goes into effect in early February. But all sorts of immigration law organizations and others who are addressing this kind of thing are taking the position, rightly so, that this new bill, Senate Bill 4, that makes illegal crossing the border a state crime is unconstitutional. And why is that? Why is it that this particular legislation passed by the legislature, signed by the governor, why is it unconstitutional? Because the case is that the federal government, under our federal constitution, is exclusively responsible for immigration matters. The bill would make it a state crime to cross the Texas-Mexico border between ports of entry. And that new crime under state law is contrary to our Constitution, which again establishes exclusive federal authority by the federal Congress. They're the ones who are responsible for overseeing that kind of thing. The governor, in connection with these other pieces, these other packages of legislation that have passed and that he has now signed, certainly can go ahead and do things like increasing law enforcement, building more structures there to address the issue. But this issue of rendering illegal the movement across the Texas-Mexico border, that's a matter exclusively within the federal jurisdiction, and therefore getting a lot of negative response. U.S. Representative Joaquin Castro from San Antonio and other Democrats in Congress signed a letter asking the Department of Justice to sue Texas to stop the law from taking effect. Highly likely that the Department of Justice, indications already that the Department of Justice is going to do just that. The letter from members of Congress says, "We urge you to assert your authority over federal immigration and foreign policy and pursue legal action to stop this unconstitutional and dangerous legislation from going into effect." The proposed legislation, which would allow, again, a state court magistrate judge to issue a removal order, is not lawful. Immigration, plainly a federal function, state legislators cannot enact immigration laws for the same reasons that the United States Congress cannot enact Texas state legislation. State magistrate judges cannot conduct immigration proceedings for the same reason that federal immigration judges cannot adjudicate Texas state criminal cases. All of that in this very thoughtful and accurate statement coming out of members of Congress asking the Department of Justice to seek judicial review of this new legislation coming out of Texas, seeking to have it rendered ruled unconstitutional, presumably by a federal court there in Texas. Now, you may remember that this is not the first time that this issue, this contest, if you will, between a state and the federal government has become a part of our history. You may remember that way back in 2010, Arizona lawmakers did much the same thing. They passed something called Senate Bill 1070. You may remember that. That made it a state crime for legal immigrants not to carry their immigration papers and required police to investigate the immigration status of any person that they came in contact with. Again, action by state officials in connection with enforcing federal immigration law. And in a very important 2012 case, the United States Supreme Court, about which we're going to be chatting at great length in just a few moments, ruled in that case, and a challenge to that Arizona matter, ruled that local police do not have the authority to arrest someone based solely on their immigration status, and significantly, that responsibility for this kind of thing falls squarely and exclusively inside the federal government. Nonetheless, the Texas legislature, the Texas governor, going ahead just in recent times with legislation almost certainly unconstitutional when it comes to the enforcement of federal law, presumably by a state officials enacting and enforcing state law now passed by the legislature there in the state of Texas. We'll continue to monitor that to determine exactly what happens as the Department of Justice pursues that matter, that rule of law matter, that constitutional matter in the state of Texas, underscoring, as we often do on this broadcast, the importance of our Constitution when it comes to state actions and the ways in which our Constitution affects daily lives, in this case, the lives of immigrants and others coming to this nation seeking asylum, other kinds of individuals seeking to avail themselves of our federal laws. We don't have to go too far. We go right down to the state of Illinois, just across our southern border here, to talk this morning about a second rule of law snapshot. It has to do with something that happened just this past week in the courts, this one in Illinois. Former Chicago Alderman Ed Burke, you may recall his name, once a very powerful Democrat, was found guilty just this past week of 13 of 14 corruption charges, including racketeering, bribery, and extortion. The case once again highlighting what seems to be the continuing high-level corruption in Chicago's city government involving political favors for money. The trial also implicated along the way, according to all reporting, other officials, revealing once again some of this widespread corruption in Illinois and resulting in numerous convictions. The U.S. attorney there, again, in this case in the federal court, the U.S. attorney named Morris Pasquale said this case was about bribery and extortion occurring at the highest level of Chicago city government. Went on to say Alderman Burke is a very powerful alderman. This case has had massive publicity, and I'd like to thank the public officials who are out there who are tempted to start down this path and that they should be on further notice about the federal government being out there. The FBI is out there, all of that, the U.S. attorney is saying, as a deterrent to this future conduct. Now, why do I raise this issue? Once again, it underscores the significance of our federal courts in enforcing the law, that on a regular basis, it is our court system, in this case, the federal courts, but also the state courts, that are important when it comes to enforcing law, to ensuring integrity in our elected government. When we come back and talk more about not only federal courts, state courts, but the administration of justice in the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Stay with us for that discussion.
Step on up and enjoy what's on tap today. Local talk about the Valley and all of Wisconsin. In fact, it's on tap every day. This is 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. Gaza residents say Israeli tanks are moving south, targeting refugee camps where it says Hamas is operating. CBS's Ian Lee reports from near Gaza.
Israel continues to expand its war in Gaza. According to the UN, nearly 2 million Palestinians have now been displaced from the fighting.
More huge waves are expected in California after massive surf Thursday brought flooding and damage. Dan Roundtree lives in Ventura.
Washed down the street like it was a river that turned and went into our complex and flooded it completely. So we're all trying to recoup.
More than 120 people were rescued when the ice floe they were fishing on in northern Minnesota broke off. Nicole Biaggi is with the Department of Natural Resources.
It's really not uncommon in the sense that it does happen from year to year that people go out there and the ice breaks away and we have to rescue them.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
Packers head to Minnesota. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It's the border battle. The Packers and the Vikings on Sunday Night Football, New Year's Eve, inside the big glass box with huge speakers. In downtown Minneapolis, known as U.S. Bank Stadium, both teams at 7-8, still alive for a playoff spot. Matt LaFleur.
I think this is one of the best venues to go play a football game in. Their fans are very supportive of the home team, and they do a great job of making it chaotic for the opposing team, especially for opposing offenses.
College football, the Badgers are in Tampa getting ready for Monday's ReliaQuest Bowl. Kickoff 11 a.m. on New Year's Day. Luke Fickell says to beat number 13th ranked LSU, he's counting on Wisconsin's offensive line.
You know, I really like where we are with those five guys, the Jack Nelsons and you know, Riley Malmans and Joe Hubers. It's played a lot of football. In particular, those guys have got to be tough, nasty dudes.
That's Badgers head coach Luke Fickell. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, cloudy skies with some drizzle and snow. We'll see a high near 33. For tonight, snow and 27. Chance of snow on your Sunday, cloudy skies and a high near 33. For Sunday night, partly cloudy, a low of 19. New Year's Day, sunshine and 32.
It's 30 at our studios.
One in four Americans today are living with a disability. I'm one of them. People with disabilities are extremely talented, resilient problem solvers that have so much to offer. And we've got a trusted ally on our side, an organization we can rely on, Easter Seals. Easter Seals is leading the way to full equity, inclusion, and access to healthcare, employment, and education for people with disabilities, families, and communities. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours.
Learn more and get involved at EasterSeals.com.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Timeout!
All right! Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
I was proud to be a soldier.
I told the truth and got kicked out.
And so I thought to myself, I'm taking this rule down.
If you're an LGBTQ plus veteran, your memories are important too. Share your story with the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, where firsthand accounts from U.S. military veterans are preserved and made accessible for researchers and future generations. Visit loc.gov/vets to submit your stories, photographs, and documents today.
From Lake Wissota State Park and the Pablo Center, the entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown. 93.5, The Tap.
With one breath, with one flow, you will
are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for once again joining me and Anya for our discussion, inviting your phone calls, your comments, your questions, your inquiries about the subject matters on our syllabus this morning. Turning now back, as we have before, to the United States Supreme Court. We have talked at great length in recent broadcasts about this notion of the administrative state. The administrative state bandied about by presidential candidate Donald Trump as a means of attacking our agencies, the good civil servants who are out there doing their jobs every single day. Donald Trump, during the course of his recent campaign, has described this as being inside the deep state. He said, "We will demolish this deep state. We'll expel the warmongers from among our government. We will drive out the globalists. We will cast out the communists, Marxists, and the fascists, and we will throw off the sick political class that hates our country." All very strong language by presidential candidate Donald Trump. Inside that, an attack upon a suspicion about the administrative state, as we've chatted before, about agencies in our government, across our government, that make government work. The significant people, the civil servants who every day go to their jobs, serving you, serving me in a variety of different ways, without politics, without partisan animation at all. Those are the kinds of people who rely upon to keep our government strong and secure. That's the attack that is underway right now by the Trump campaign. Even as that goes on in the political agenda, there are these three cases pending before the United States Supreme Court that also codify, that somewhat dress up, but codify in many ways this suspicion about our administrative, our federal agencies. And we've talked about them before. I'm going to mention them again this morning because it is important to understand that this concept of distrust of the government and of people who are inside our government and the need, as Donald Trump has said, to get rid of them, that is a part of not only the campaign, but presumably, implicitly, if not explicitly, also part of the arguments being made in context of these three cases pending before the United States Supreme Court. We have talked about them before. There's this case called SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission versus Jarkasi, a case in which there is an attack upon the very legitimacy of the Securities and Exchange Commission, around for 90 years, operating to ensure that securities and the transmission, the movement of monies, the insurance of our government when it comes to financial and fiscal security is maintained. All of that under attack, in this case, SEC versus Jarkasi. Significant that coming out of the oral argument way back in the fall of this year, coming out of that argument, probably a strong suspicion from at least some members of our Supreme Court about the very legitimacy, whether the SEC, based upon instruction given it by the Congress 90 years ago, including this argument that the SEC is required, when it comes to making decisions, is responsible for providing jury trials to people who are coming before it to contest and argue about cases in the securities area. A huge change in the administrative practice, which we'll get back to again. That case, pending before the Supreme Court, coming up for decision presumably in January of this next year. A second case called CFPB, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, versus Community Financial Services Association. This one likewise attacking this agency intended to protect the rights, the interests of consumers coming out of the economic crisis of 2007, 2008, in place ever since then, a challenge to it based upon its funding source and whether or not it can continue to operate on behalf of the American people. Those two cases pending before the Supreme Court. In the case of CFPB, that case argued among the very first cases in the fall of this year. And the third case coming up in just a couple of weeks, January 17th, Wednesday, January 17th, the United States Supreme Court will be addressing and taking up the merits of a case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. Again, we have chatted about this before, but of all the cases on the docket of the Supreme Court this term, this is the one that most centrally codifies the suspicion about and lack of deference to the experts, the scientists, the medical people, the educators, the business people, the commercial folks, folks involved in education, the arts, all the people who know things. This is the one that is the greatest attack, if you will, upon the agencies in our government that do their work based upon the expertise that they bring to their jobs. The particular case comes out of a decision by something called the National Marine Fisheries Service. It has to do with interpretation of who's going to pay for compliance monitors on fishing boats. Although, as important as that issue is, the larger issue is whether or not a 40-year, four-decade judicial standard articulated 40 years ago in a case called Chevron versus NRDC, whether that will stand. The Supreme Court probably primed to overturn 40 years of tradition. And what is that tradition under Chevron? That concept is that when a federal court has to interpret federal law passed by the United States Congress, and that law with respect to a particular application of it is either incomplete or even silent on it, traditionally under this Chevron doctrine articulated and followed for 40 years of judicial interpretation in America, that doctrine calls upon federal courts to defer not completely, but reasonably to the experts inside federal agencies. And that includes, once again, the people who are educated, who are experienced, who know what they're talking about. And the Chevron doctrine directs that federal courts look to guidance, direction from the people who are experienced. Abandoning that concept of reliance upon people who do have that experience, that insight in all different areas of our common practice, our engagement with each other, abandoning that would place federal judges in the position of substituting, giving them authority to substitute their own gut feelings, their own senses, perhaps even articulating new versions of long-established principles that are not founded in the experience and the integrity and the life experience of these folks inside our federal agencies. That's what's at stake on January 17th, going to be decided almost certainly in June of next year, in this case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. There's also a second case involving Relentless, that's the name of the case, joined with it on that day, also for oral argument. And again, why is this significant? Why do we talk about it so frequently now? Because in addition to the cases involving firearms in America, in addition to cases involving social media and many other cases that we'll continue to cover in 2024 and beyond, I would offer to you that this litigation, this challenge to the work that's going on right now in our federal agencies, codified in these three cases pending before the United States Supreme Court right now, this is the institutionalization of the attack on the administrative state that we also see in the political arena, regrettably, today. June is going to be the time, and we'll hear about the extent to which the Supreme Court is buying into or not buying into that. But plainly, June is also going to be right in the middle of our campaigns for the presidency and for other elective offices in America. And for that reason, it is important for all of us to appreciate the significance of these cases, to talk about them, to let each other know that they're pending right now, and yes, indeed, to engage in discussion about the significance of our administrative agencies when it comes to making government work. How does that play out in an individual basis? I suspect that many, if not all of you, have had contact with federal agencies in many different ways. The Internal Revenue Service, the Social Security Administration, Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Small Business Administration, Health and Human Services, all kinds of agencies out there where individuals go to seek redress of concerns, problems, sometimes grievances. And in all of those instances, who do you talk to? You talk to people who are there employed to be the experts. That's not to say you have to agree with them, but simply to engage with them based upon their experience, their assigned mission to assist and support the people of the United States of America in advancing the missions of those various agencies that are out there. When that administrative state, so-called, is chipped away, when we no longer have reliance upon and even deference to the good judgment and sound judgment of those people who make judgment calls all the time, when that begins to disintegrate, our republic once again begins to fall. Now, that is not to say, of course, that we can't fight with our federal agencies. We do that as a part of our national experience. And indeed, when you are unhappy with, when you're dissatisfied with decisions of any of those agencies with whom you may have some engagement, what do? Then you can go to federal court. You can seek redress of your grievances there. But the first cut, the first stop is always those agencies. And the notion that, whether it's in federal court or before that, that we no longer trust those agencies to be legitimate and to be honest, at least in engaging with us on the important issues that are significant to individuals, that's the challenge that's out there right now. And that's the reason why these cases are very important. And that, as we'll talk again in our second hour, is also animating this focus upon an attack on the administrative state and civil servants in particular. We're going to talk in our second hour about something called Schedule F that the former president and perhaps future president plans to put in place that addresses once again what he identifies as this largely unknown group of thousands of civil servants out there doing things we do not know about and attacking them for legitimate work that they are doing. We're going to talk more about that in our second hour, codified once again by these three cases pending before the United States Supreme Court even now. There are three other cases that are also before the Supreme Court, this in our final broadcast of 2023, that we should also remember and recall significantly because they continue to change even this past week. We have seen three different matters affecting Donald Trump, affecting his candidacy, affecting the possibility that he may be or not be on the ballots of our nation state. Let's go back and talk about some of those in particular. Last broadcast, we spent a lot of time talking about this major landmark decision coming out of the Colorado Supreme Court, finding that not only Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits someone who's engaged in insurrection, having previously taken an oath of office, prohibits them from appearing on the ballot, but also finding significantly that the presidency is among those offices that are subject to restriction under that Civil War Amendment. Colorado, the Supreme Court finding that Donald Trump cannot be on the ballot for the primary election coming up there in the state of Colorado. This past week, a couple more important decisions in both directions, underscoring the need, the likelihood that the United States Supreme Court will take up this 14th Amendment case among the three that is pending right now. On Wednesday, the Michigan Supreme Court again paved the way, if you will, for Donald Trump to appear on that state's primary ballot, basically finding that an appeals court decision that determined that the former president could appear on the ballot despite questions about his eligibility, the appeals court decision would be upheld. That going on by the state's high court there in Michigan. That Michigan decision, of course, following the Colorado Supreme Court decision, which had determined back on December 19th, that in a 4-3 opinion that Trump should be removed from the state's 2024 Republican primary ballot. So we've got the Michigan Supreme Court saying that he will not be removed from the ballot there in the state of Michigan. And then we have the Colorado Supreme Court earlier saying that, yes, indeed, he would be. The Michigan Supreme Court did not rule out the question of Donald Trump's disqualification for engaging in insurrection against the U.S. Constitution if it's resolved at a later stage. And so, again, we're at the primary stage right now. The Supreme Court in Michigan not ruling out the possibility of revisiting that down the road. We've got Michigan this past week finding that Donald Trump will remain on the primary ballot there. The issue there also significantly coming up in the state of Maine. When we come back after this break, we'll talk about what happened in the state of Maine, the officials there in the state making an important determination in this same area. Stay with us for that discussion.
Yeah. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
Folks, I tell you this much, the Cripes Cast is just the butter on my cheese.
Mike and Pat, the hosts of the Crash Dummies podcast.
I was born in Nigeria, actually.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was in Nigerian boarding school for like 3 years. It's like a prison sentence. We were trying to prison break our way out of there because they took our passports. So I was trying to like have people send me money so I can find a new passport.
Wait. You were in Nigeria trying to have people send you money?
Yeah, trying to escape.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
93.5 The Tap.
And we are back for this, our final segment in our first hour here on our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about this 14th Amendment issue, almost certainly percolating its way up to the United States Supreme Court. One of three different cases before the Supreme Court having to do with the legitimacy of Donald Trump's candidacy and other areas, including the criminal prosecutions against us. We'll talk about those related cases in just a moment or so. Again, the history on this recently, the Colorado Supreme Court finding that Donald Trump's name should be removed from the primary ballot in that state. We have Michigan this past week going in the opposite direction. The Supreme Court there finding that he should, in fact, remain on the ballot in that state. And then one day after Michigan makes that determination, we have Maine going in the opposite direction. Maine joining Colorado in finding Donald Trump ineligible for the primary ballot there on Thursday, becoming the second state to order that he remain off the ballot, although not without some internal remedies available to Donald Trump inside the state of Maine itself. The Secretary of State, her name is Shenna Bellows, wrote in her decision that Mr. Trump did not qualify for the ballot because of his role in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Significantly, under Maine law, the peculiar circumstances, the structure of Maine law, a handful of citizens had challenged his eligibility by claiming that, once again, he had incited an insurrection, invoking the language of the 14th Amendment, and was thus barred from appearing on the ballot there in the state of Maine. The Secretary of State Bellows writes this. She says, "I am mindful that no Secretary of State has ever deprived a presidential candidate of ballot access based on Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. I am also mindful, however, that no presidential candidate has ever before engaged in insurrection." And again, this comes in the wake of Colorado and Michigan and some 30 other states out there that are also wrestling with the same kind of thing. All of this anticipating other decisions, likewise coming out of other states, Oregon coming up fairly soon as well. The significance is, of course, that in Michigan, as we said, a Supreme Court making a decision. In Colorado, the Supreme Court making the decision. In Maine, this coming out from the Secretary of State. She is considered the responsible official there for making this initial determination after this petition is filed with her. And in this 34-page decision, Ms. Bellows again wrote that Mr. Trump's petition to appear on the ballot was invalid because he falsely declared on his candidate consent form in the state of Maine that he was qualified to hold the office of the presidency. That's the specific basis upon which she found that he was not, in fact, going to be on that ballot. She wrote, "Because the record establishes that Mr. Trump, over the course of several months and culminating on January 6th, used a false narrative of election fraud to inflame his supporters and direct them, that required," she said, "in the state of Maine that he remain off the ballot." She concluded that Donald Trump was aware of the likelihood for violence and that at least initially supported its use, given he both encouraged it with incendiary rhetoric and took no timely action to stop it. The references there, the pronoun references there, to the events of January 6th in her decision. Now, Donald Trump, again, based upon the laws there in the state of Maine, can in fact appeal the Bellows decision to Maine's Superior Court within 5 days. And her order is not going to go into effect until the court rules on that appeal, which the Trump campaign said it's intending to file very soon. The Republican primaries in Maine and Colorado are both scheduled for March 5th, both for March 5th. That's also the date known as Super Tuesday, underscoring the importance of some resolution of this matter on or before, long before that date, for the legitimacy of not only the voting in those states, but also around the country. On the same, virtually right after that happened in Maine, California, the Secretary of State there found that she does not have the responsibility, the obligation, the authority there to do a similar thing, as did the official there in the state of Maine. And so we get California now finding that Donald Trump will remain on the ballot there in that state. All of this certainly headed to the United States Supreme Court in a case that will be decided, presumably by the justices, sooner rather than later. The likely anticipated decision there is going to be that the Supreme Court will overturn the decisions in Colorado. If the Maine decision sticks, those kinds of things, those decisions being made by the court, ultimately also in Maine there as well, likely, highly likely that the United States Supreme Court will find that Donald Trump should be on the ballot. And why do I say that? I say that for a couple of reasons. One is there are plenty of bases upon which the United States Supreme Court can find that the process, principally procedural issues there in those courts, was inadequate. Not saying that it was indeed inadequate, but there's a basis upon which they can skirt the issue and not determine whether or not Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does in fact apply. They can rely upon some other procedural matters. They can find, for instance, that there are certain things that were not afforded Donald Trump in Colorado, which is a part of his argument being made. Very likely the Supreme Court is going to find that Donald Trump will remain on the ballots in these states. And it's for that reason, that I identify these cases, although they're grabbing the headlines today, as significant, but not ultimately the one that is most determinative, most significant for what the Supreme Court is going to be doing when it comes to Donald Trump in 2024. That's the first set of cases, or maybe just one case, depending upon how this percolates up from Colorado, other places, before the Supreme Court in this term. The second batch of matters before the Supreme Court have to do with the criminal prosecutions of him that are now underway in the District of Columbia District Court. We know that one of the challenges to the District Court prosecution of him, this is the prosecution brought by Jack Smith, the Department of Justice, the special counsel, bringing this case in Tanya Chutkan's courtroom in four different counts. We're going to talk about those counts in just a moment or so, in which the defense on behalf of Donald Trump has raised the concept that absolute immunity bars Donald Trump from being prosecuted by the Department of Justice in that case. That matter, the Supreme Court recently indicated, has to stay at the Court of Appeals for its resolution. The Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia scheduled an oral argument for January 9th. And when we come back after the top of the hour break here, I'll tell you more about that particular case. And then we're going to talk about the single most important case involving Donald Trump that's also pending before the United States Supreme Court, goes to the very legitimacy of that prosecution right after this break. Stay with us here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Tell a friend what's on tap. There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley. This is 93.5 The Tap. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us. and click on the Careers tab.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is